submission to the Upper House inquiry into the Fit for the Future process, local government reform. First, thanks for the ability to provide a submission in audio form, given a disability and a loss of writing capacity, and a willingness to accept the submission late in view of me not realising this was an option. My comments here extend from my 5-minute public forum submission in Armidale. I think my comments and views at this point may be of significance and of value to the sitting committee in terms of the rollout of the FFF process to date and issues such as amalgamation and so forth, particularly in a regional context and specifically for the Northern Tablelands region. I feel I'm in a good position to make comment that's helpful to the committee in view of a number of factors. First, I'm probably the most read-up ratepayer in the Northern Tablelands, having read pretty well all the research documents and background to the FFF process, the government's response to the original recommendations. I've participated in past forums looking at amalgamations in the Northern Tablelands. And then there's my personal background. I've grown up and lived in Sydney, moved to a regional centre, namely Armidale, and lived for several years, and then moved to a rural shire and live in a small rural village. I've been involved and valued and still have a sense of belonging to all three of these places. Now, I really want to get into the points I have for the committee, so in terms of a bit more detail on my background and why I think I'm in a very good in situ observational position to comment in a way of value to the committee, I'll put it at the end. I'm now going to cover 9 or 10 general points with the FFF process. This will be part one. Then discuss 2 particular aspects in detail that I think are particularly important for the committee's consideration. This will be part two. And then put together what I think may be a workable model in the Northern Tablelands case that both achieves the intentions and goals of the FFF process, but also does it in a way that I think may well have strong ratepayer support across the Tablelands. And that will be part three. Part one, general points. Now, the first point, as a broad point, is that I do feel the pace of the FFF process has been far too short for the broad ratepayer base to have an opportunity to fully appreciate or understand the opportunity presented by the FFF process in regards to reform of local government in their region. Most people I've spoken to on the ground did not actually recognise what the FFF process was, but eventually twigged and would say a comment to effect of, oh, you mean amalgamations. I do understand that there was no requirement for local government to consult with their communities on the FFF process. I understand that councillors are the local representative to make decisions on behalf of the ratepayers. However, the depth and breadth of opportunity for real changes and reform that some people have wanted the opportunity for change for decades, to me, warrants a much broader consultation with the ratepayers to which the reform concerns. One aspect that comes to mind in particular, and from my reading I understand this to be so, that there's an opportunity in the FFF process to consider local government area boundaries in a way that has not been opened and possible for a number of decades. For a long time in regional areas, there's been discussion of the efficiency gain that can be achieved through looking at bioregions or economic activity regions as a way to better align local government regions. So I'm not talking about local government shires specifically individually, but a group of them, such as the Northern Tablelands, where you have Glen Innes, Kyra, Walker, Yirrala and Armidale, including former shires of Jimmerik and Severn, and possibly including Inverell, Gwydir, Tenterfield, all round collectively in a geographical higher elevation area with a dominant grazing agricultural economic production system, as distinctly different in personal culture, tourism opportunities, economic activity as the coastal regions or the Western Plains. Defining the boundaries of a cluster of local government areas to a natural bioregion does lend itself to an efficiency of operation for those councils. It does simplify the diversity of brief they need to be on top of in exercising their responsibilities and their services. So here for the first time, there is the genuine opportunity to look at the concept of economic or bioregions as a way to greatly improve efficiency in regional New South Wales. And yet it has no discussion in the current debate, in the current consultation process. With boundary adjustments separate to the regional view, there are some local circumstances that I don't think have had consideration either. Like, I wonder if the people in the Karai Plateau, in the south-east corner of Armidale-Demerick Shire, which are located quite remote in terms of ease of access for Armidale-Demerick Shire to service, are aware that in this process they could be looking at whether they'd be better off in a coastal shire. I think it might be Kempsey, simply for plain efficiency, ability to access and provide services. Also, I look at the town of Ebor, which is half in Kyra Shire and Armidale Shire, where in the consultation process they were aware that they might have a choice to raise whether they want to be wholly in one shire or another. Certainly on the Tablelands, the FFF process has basically come down to a discussion purely around amalgamation and a tit for tat. You know, sacrifice the weakest link and negotiate some change of boundaries to improve your rate revenue from neighbouring shires. I find this parochialism, the negative example of it, very disappointing and a major loss of opportunity with this process. Returning to a regional Northern Tablelands view from a ratepayer's perspective, from my inquiries, there seems a support for some kind of regional level cooperation. The primary barrier in most ratepayers' minds is the loss of local representation and that process happening through forced amalgamations of one council over another. Kyra, to its credit, in its consultation process, actually engaged with ratepayers over what they saw as a possible best outcomes for the, including over the Northern Tablelands as a whole. Now, in their consultation, the strongest support was for retaining Kyra Shire as it is, that is, to not have the amalgamation of Armidale with Kyra. But the second runner, which had quite strong support, was if there was going to be any amalgamations, to go to a full Northern Tablelands combined regional council, or even preferably joint organisation and cooperation across the councils on a regional basis, So that local representation was still retained, but there was the potential economy of scale benefits and the formation of some more regional identity. This is preferable because you're not putting the stamp of one existing council over the rest of the Tablelands. That new regional structure, however it's done, would be a new structure and not representative of any existing council. I think the support for that was something like 37%, if I recall. And when I've talked to people in other shires, locally, as ordinary ratepayers, a regional view does have support, it's just how it's done. Now, the following comments really are my own, simply because with the lack of consultation, there really isn't any view I can draw upon from others as on the ratepayer level. General point two. As part of the FFF process, from what I've read, it seems there is some proposal for the state government to gather some of the funding streams from Commonwealth level to local government and in some way have more control over the distribution of that funding. Now, as a broad democratic principle with the three tiers of government, I believe strongly that the revenue processes through grants, etc., from Commonwealth or state to local government should remain transparent and not interfered with. I just think in the triangle between the three levels of government in this country, as a democratic country, they should be left to flow freely. Now, this doesn't remove the opportunity or the choice of councils, for example, on a regional joint organisation level, for example, agreeing to commit a certain portion of their successful grant streams into some regional pool, but that's a choice at local government level. Now, point three, again, very short. That might help the committee. The assessment of a number of people I've spoken to, including general managers, is that the funding offered as an incentive or to cover the cost of amalgamations of council within the FF process is basically just sufficient to achieve the cost of that amalgamation, including restructuring staff, personnel, wages, etc., contracts. And there would be none left over once that council has those councils have amalgamated. I just thought it was a point of some value to mention. Now, general point four. I feel concerned of the emphasis in the FFF process on the concept of achieving better efficiency at local government level through economy of scale. Now, clearly, economy of scale can bring significant efficiencies, but it's not the only dimension and the only factor that leads to improved efficiency. And some of the other dimensions that can improve efficiency can be quite the opposite. Its smaller scale brings greater efficiency. To achieve good local government reform, economy of scale needs to be part of it. But to ignore the other factors that bring and achieve efficiency would be for the process to fail, in my view. Related to this is also how the FF process judges the efficiency of a council, a local government area. I intend to go into these two aspects in detail a little later. Point five. In the process of seeking larger council areas, one of the downsides that I see that could be quite significant is with larger council areas, when it comes to elections, the role of political parties becomes much more significant in the chance of success of a candidate to be elected in terms of their profile. Now, this tends to bring for smaller, what are currently small, rural shires, if amalgamated into a much bigger structure, it brings the process of the formation of councils through the elected candidates into the party political system. And in my view, and looking at, for example, some of the factionalism in, say, a big council like Armidale versus small council like Walker or Gyra, you tend to get factional groups. One's in power at one point, then another one comes into power and reverses some of the decisions. And from my observation, that tangle of factions fighting with each other within local government councils probably produces a much greater inefficiency in the process of decision-making and long-term evolution of decisions and projects than the FFF process is likely to achieve through economy of scale reforms. I can't prove that. It's just an observation to perception. But I think that a lot of other ratepayers would understand that view and share my concern. Point six. As a segue to the last point, larger councils become increasingly more remote to their constituents, their ratepayers. There becomes an increased administrative barrier. Their ratepayers become more alienated from their council, and furthermore, there becomes more opportunity for cartels of interest to dominate council, business interests, financial interests, etc. I note that where there's been some major corruption involving the ICAC at local government level, it's generally been in large councils. Now, I'm not saying there can't be some similar level with smaller councils, but in smaller councils, councillors are much closer to the community. They are held accountable every day as they walk down the street with every decision they make. They get immediate feedback. They are daily approachable by the ratepayers. There is a very efficient, natural check on level of diligence and attention to ratepayers' interests in small councils. So this is an example where there is an efficiency that it is achieved with small councils rather than economy of scale, and bigger is better. When it comes to assessing the efficiency of local government, I just wonder if the cost of not only ICAC investigations with large councils, but also the cost of the corruptions uncovered is factored into an assessment of what size councils are more efficient. I certainly don't see this covered in any of the past research. That is a foundation out of IPART for the FFF process. Point seven. One of the drivers for economy of scale, amalgamation of councils, larger councils, is a view of a failure for local government, particularly rural ones, to maintain and stay up to date with their infrastructure maintenance. I'm at the point that I feel this view of how to judge local councils in the current FFF assessment process is somewhat flawed. For a lot of regional rural councils, rate pegging introduced over 25 years ago has greatly limited the ability of smaller councils to meet and maintain their infrastructure costs. Some of them were frozen into very low rate structures at the time because that's what their ratepayers wanted. And when infrastructure costs and backlogs mounted, they didn't have the opportunity, other than some special rate rise processes that came later, to change that trajectory. So in one sense, some councils have been hamstrung and then held to account and blame for their failure to keep up with their infrastructure cost. In addition to this, there is the historical decision affecting a number of rural shires of being landed with a vast road network that they are responsible for, and it not being a state responsibility, and with a sparse population, so the rate base is in proportion limited. This is where some Commonwealth funding comes in to try and balance the equation. But it's not fair to judge councils that have been frozen with very low rates, with consequences that build cumulatively, like cumulative interest, over decades, as inherently poorly functioning councils. That's not an accurate view. It is perhaps a bit of an aside, but I would be interested to know, with some of these rural shires, what level of contribution to the state economy has come out of these areas, and those goods transported, of course, over those road networks, in terms of the balance of the burden on local council and the benefit to the state economy. In terms of addressing the backlog of infrastructure through New South Wales, there are other options. For example, committing 10% of the GST, and without a GST rise, I don't believe in a GST rise, you should stay at 10%, but attributing, say, 10% of the GST revenue from the Commonwealth into funding the catch-up of infrastructure costs across New South Wales local government areas. When I've asked councillors whether they think rate picking has in fact forced and achieved a much better efficiency in local government, most councillors actually say yes it has, but also affirm that, and I would agree with them, that the benefit of that strategy has well and truly finished now. There is not more efficiency to be gained. Now, one of the consequences of that strategy as a downside has been the forced marginalisation of the viability of councils to maintain their infrastructure. So in one sense, redirecting 10% of GST revenue from the Commonwealth to the states, say over a limited 10-year period involving what I think would be around $10 billion to catch up on infrastructure costs is in one sense not an unreasonable suggestion. It's actually a way to complete the efficiency strategy of rate pegging and bringing things back to balance. Next point, point eight, is in some sense a segue to the last point. Certainly in the Tablelands and rural, traditional rural councils versus regional city councils, it's a very strong view of mine that, and I would like the committee to recognise or consider the view that there is quite an incompatibility in some respects between a way a city council needs to structure its rates and operate and the expectations of its ratepayers versus a rural council, and simply forcing an amalgamation between the two is not that workable. Now, specifically, let me take Armidale and Gyra. Armidale's, most of its population is in the city of Armidale. I mean, it has voluntarily asked and sought to take over a rural shire, the traditional Dumeric shire, of its own volition. But fundamentally, it's a city council, and a lot of its ratepayers are income earners in that city that are prepared to pay higher rates, want to pay high rates because they want a high level of daily service. In contrast, people in rural shires such as Gyra have generally been people at the poorer end of the scale salary. People have moved to live in those shires as a access to a cheaper style of living. It's a rural self-help type culture from the beginning. So most people have trailers, they're happy to take their own trash to the tip, for example. They will voluntarily help maintain local villages with their own mowing, etc., etc. There is, and so the wish that is reflected in the rate structure of rural shires is lower rates for less services, because that's what the ratepayers and the lifestyle of ratepayers in those rural shires are equipped to be able to do and how they need to be. Lower cost of living, lower charges, but less services. It's very difficult to put a city council with higher salaried ratepayers and combine it with a rural council. They are two quite different structures and different sets of needs. And I think this is a very important point when amalgamations are considered. I understand that there has been an issue in the past historically with what you call donut councils. And hence the amalgamations of Armidale with Dumerriek. However, the area required to relieve a growing city from constraint, being surrounded by a different donut rural shire, is easily addressed with expanding the local government area of the city council so it can grow without necessarily consuming entire vast rural shires to achieve that goal. It doesn't have to be done the way it was done with Armidale and Dumerriek. Point 9. And again, it's a segue to the last point. One concern I do feel very strongly with the FF process and the attempt to roll out bigger shires, better efficiency in regional areas from a city perspective, is the plight of people in existing rural shires. A lot of ratepayers in Gyra or Euralla or Walker in Old Severn Shire, Old Dumerriek Shire, they've lived in these shires for 50 or 60 years as people who, well, they may not be particularly good at school, they don't have the kind of city-like career prospects. They're the backbone of rural New South Wales. They work hard. They've chosen to move to these shires as people who are not likely to be high income earners ever, and have worked hard and built lives, renovated their houses, slowly built and made a future, made an existence for themselves. Rolling out some wonderful improvement in efficiency of local government that creates considerably increased rates, which is kind of an oxymoron to improved efficiency from a ratepayer point of view. But I can see in terms of infrastructure costs from a state government point of view why the term efficiency is used. It concerns me there's a great risk of economically marginalising many of these areas with poor people. I noticed the ABS stats recently identified some of the poorest locality areas in Australia are in the northwest part of New South Wales, including within the local government areas I'm discussing here on the Northern Tablelands. There is a risk in the attempt for efficiency to actually create downstream problems that cost a great deal in the fracturing of these people's lives by simply pricing them out of the areas they have learnt to live and get by in and make their home in. Now this is, I think, a very real concern. Where do these people go if they find that they're priced out of their own locality? I mean, rate rises as part of the FFF process is only one part. There's gas going up. There's a whole lot of costs that are going up. And I don't think the level of risk and danger here is easily recognised from a city and state government point of view, unless it's pointed out. I'm actually an example of this with my own life journey. I've ended up moving to Armidale, one, to find work, but also because I couldn't afford to maintain and compete in Sydney, so I had to move to an area where costs were less, and then eventually to this small rural community, into an old rural house. I could buy in circumstances other people might see as almost unacceptable. I still don't have hot running water. I've got to heat it on a stove and organise it. But I've had a chance to rebuild because I've moved to a place where I can afford to live as someone who's been forced into marginal circumstances and have the opportunity to rebuild a life. And rural shires provide that opportunity for a lot of people, and people work very hard to turn their lives around in that way. And in some respects, that is preferable to simply borrowing money, going bankrupt, and driving other people bankrupt, as is the habit of, as an alternative way that people handle that situation. Some of the rate rises being considered by councils to meet criterias for standalone are quite significant, and furthermore, once the FFF process is complete, and a lot of people don't seem to realise this, that the traditional process of rate pegging will cease. So therefore the opportunity for councils, depending on what the new arrangements are, to increase rates to prove financial viability in future is going to be a lot easier than it has been in the past. When you combine that with the fact that the FFF process is a broad sweep right across New South Wales, there is a danger of broad-scale marginalisation of people in very poor circumstances that are currently eking out a satisfactory life and a productive life in rural areas, and where there are not backup services as alternatives. Now, should this kind of phenomena actually occur, I see it two ways it unfolds. Firstly, if there is a significant fallout, the state government ends up picking up an increased cost, a cascade cost down the track in counselling, reneging on paying rates, bankruptcies, suicides, relationship breakdown, aged people without support and needing support services, etc., etc. In which case, then, the net balance of the efficiency of the FFF process is basically undermined and even turned into a negative. The second way it could unfold, which unfortunately there is precedent, and I think of a classic example is the closure of the Gladesville psychiatric facility in the late 1990s, might have been the 1980s, where the negative consequences are simply just ignored and left off the spreadsheet, so that the reforms appear efficient when in fact, in reality, they haven't been at all. It's just that the downside cost has been translated into quite severe and significant human suffering of people who were, in this case, legitimate ratepayers and who worked hard over their lifetime. Now, on a moral ethical basis, that would be completely unacceptable, but it would not be unprecedented. Anyway, this is an area of a danger zone that I see that could occur, and I'm not even suggesting it would happen intentionally, but it could occur. Point 10. This is partially a segue to the last point, but also going back to a potential downside of only looking at economy of scale and seeking much larger LGA areas right across New South Wales. with the formation of much larger councils, I think there can be a tendency towards administrative convergence into a kind of administrative monoculture with less variation from one regional area to another. I see that diversity of local government councils, or at least regions, collections of councils like the Northern Tablelands across New South Wales, is something not to be lost. It may not, from a city administrative point of view, enable the absolute tweaking of maximum cost efficiency, but a diversity of regions in New South Wales does make for a more robust state, particularly if there are periods of adversity, global financial crisis, future droughts, climate change, any number of circumstances that we can't predict over the next 100 years. Having regions that offer diversity, I think, makes the state stronger in the long term.